Well, good afternoon to all of you. I'm sure you all noticed the extra accompaniment on the first piece there with the two flautists, Mrs. Linda Hawk and Mrs. Anita Miller on flute, and Mrs. Kathy Henry on the piano. It's always good to see so much participation in the special music. I tried last fall on the Feast of Trumpets to sneak into the choir practice in the middle of the day, but that choir director has something of an eagle eye, and she spotted me up in the back riser, and she went like this. So that was the end of that. So much for my choir days. I'm not sure about all these Bible editions that Mr. Mullen have found. I'll have to work on that one. Think about that a little bit. I'm sure I can find something. But it's amazing what a difference a small thing can make. As it always happens, the week of unleavened bread has flown past. It seems so very short a time ago that we were finishing up the last stages of de-leavening, getting ready for the Passover service, looking ahead to the night to be much observed, and the first holy day. And now we're here for the last service, for the last message in the last service of the Days of Unleavened Bread for the year 2012. And of course, tomorrow is God's weekly Sabbath, and we'll have services again for that day, which is also holy time. So I hope no one will decide simply that that's enough church for one weekend and decide that it's not important to come back to church again tomorrow. Physical limitations aside, of course. We come before God's presence to worship Him and in obedience to His commands, whether it's an annual Sabbath or a weekly one. Holy time is holy time is holy time. And only He can sanctify a day, which He has done, both today and again tomorrow. But before we say goodbye to the spring holy days for this year, for 2012, maybe we need to ask ourselves if there's room for yet one more lesson we can learn. One more nugget of wisdom from God's Word that we can carry with us as we begin to look to the next holy day, which happens to be Pentecost, of course, which falls this year on May the 27th on our Roman calendar, and have always, as we know, on a Sunday, on the first day of the week. If you were to sit down right now, Mr. Myers talked about making a list of things because he says if you don't write it down, you won't do it. Could you list some of the insights that you've gained this past week? Has it been a week of increased awareness of spiritual lessons in your life? Was it a profitable week in that way, if not always painless? Sometimes the profitable lessons come accompanied by a little bit of uncomfortable approaches. Sometimes adding to our wisdom isn't the easiest path to follow. I would like to explore one more aspect of the nature of sin this afternoon. Maybe you think you've covered most of it in your personal study and in hearing the messages last Sabbath on the first day of Unleavened Bread, wherever you were for that location, whether Massillon or Mercer or Cleveland or somewhere else. I know we have some visitors with us from Toronto today. I don't think they were here for the last Sabbath on the first day of Unleavened Bread. It's a bit of a trip. A bit of a trip, eh? But they're here with us today. I'm wondering, though, if there's one aspect we might not tend to think of. Let me give you a brief recap of my sermon last Sabbath in Cleveland. As you heard already, we had an attendance of 88 there, but many of you here today were not. And what I have to say ties into that earlier message. In fact, when they were asking for titles to put on the material that's on the webcast or then later on the web, they asked for a title, and I gave them this one. I said, "Do you not yet know that Egypt is destroyed, part two?" Those of you who were in Cleveland already heard part one. So now I'm going to give you a brief recap, and those of you who are in Cleveland, please don't sit there saying, if he can say it in 7 minutes, why didn't he do that last week? We looked at the life and the ministry of the Apostle Paul in the early going, and how he was unique among the early apostles in that he didn't follow Christ during his earthly ministry. And he didn't grow up with him, as Jesus' half-brothers, James and Jude, did, who later wrote books in the New Testament. Paul was trained personally by Christ, according to his own explanations, in the first chapter of the book of Galatians and in 1 Corinthians 15. He talks about those things. And we saw that one of the crucial object lessons that Paul tended to draw on in his writings was the example of the ancient nation of Israel. He told the Corinthians to learn from Israel's example. And assuming that Paul was the author of the book of Hebrews, and that's the traditional view with a great deal of internal evidence to recommend it, he went back to their example again in that letter to the Hebrews. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, you're very familiar with this section of Scripture, he says in verse 1, "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food. And they all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. And do not become idolaters as some of them. And as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Nor murmur, as some of them murmured and were destroyed by the destroyer." And then he gets to the crucial point. "Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, on whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." That's the bulk of Paul's warning. He talks about the fact that there were certain specific sins that the Israelites fell prey to, and he warns us in a very annoying way, we might think, that even those of us who have God's Spirit could fall to the same temptations that a bunch of carnal Israelites did. And he says, just when you think you've got it made, watch out. Watch out, you can slip. You can be taken by surprise. That's why Paul warned us, even those of us who have God's Spirit. And we learn something about the nature of sin in those words in verse 12, that it is deceitful, it is duplicitous, it is sneaky. Sometimes we don't see it coming. Are we aware of that? We also saw, going through some of these things, and perhaps you have in your studies, even if you didn't hear this message, in the example of Pharaoh and his servants, as they were part of the experience of ancient Israel, another aspect of sin. If you go back to Exodus chapter 9, Exodus 9 and verse 33, after the seventh plague, which was the plague of the hail and the firestorm, it says, "So Moses went out of the city from Pharaoh, and he spread out his hands to the Eternal. Then the thunder and the hail ceased, and the rain was not poured on the earth. And when Pharaoh saw that the rain and the hail and the thunder had ceased, he sinned yet more, and he hardened his heart, he and his servants. So the heart of Pharaoh was hard, neither would he let the children of Israel go, as the Eternal had spoken by Moses." We also see that there is a problem with sin in that it hardens us. We don't have a soft, yielded, teachable heart anymore if we get involved in a pattern of sin. It makes it hard, a stony heart. You heard in the opening prayer today for the afternoon service, the request that God would give us a heart of flesh. The contrast there is to a heart of stone. We want a heart that is soft, a heart of flesh that can yield to God and can hear and pay attention and follow his direction. So sin, we find, hardens us. The thing is, if you go back to the New Testament, I'm not going to turn there now, but Paul, in Hebrews chapter 3, verses 7 to 15, warns that the same thing can happen to us. And in fact, that's the surprising part about Hebrews 3. We've read so many times, if you've gone through the book of Exodus in some of your studies, you know how often we find that Pharaoh's heart was hardened. But the problem, Paul said in Hebrews chapter 3, is that we can have our hearts hardened. He said, "Beware lest there is in any of you a heart that is hardened." He talked about the fact that it can cause us to have a heart of unbelief. And that was the danger. Of course, Paul was only quoting from the 95th Psalm. So apparently it was known in David's time. The 95th Psalm is an unattributed psalm. It doesn't tell us who it was by or to. It just says Psalm 95. But it was in David's day and his time because he collected them all. And so it was known in David's time that the Israelites also were caught up in the hard heart syndrome. It wasn't just Pharaoh that had hardening of the arteries. It was the Israelites too. They too had hard hearts. Maybe it rubbed off on them from their experiences in Egypt. And they left Egypt behind. As we say, you can take the Israelites out of Egypt, but you couldn't take Egypt out of the Israelites. That's the problem. And sometimes we need to be aware of that. But you know, we learned something a week ago as we went through it in our service up there. Something that happens in and around sin. And it's also in Exodus. It's in the 10th chapter. And that's where the title for the sermon comes from. Exodus 10 and verse 3. "So Moses and Aaron came in to Pharaoh and said to him, 'Thus says the eternal God of the Hebrews, how long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? Let my people go that they may serve me. Or else if you refuse to let my people go, behold, tomorrow I'll bring locusts into your territory.'" As if they weren't beaten down enough from the hailstones. "And they'll cover the face of the earth so that no one will be able to see the earth." You know, I can just imagine, perhaps their dwellings weren't quite as tightly sealed as ours in northeastern Ohio. You go to sit in your favorite barca lounger and it kind of moves under you as you sit in it. And it squirms. The locusts were everywhere. "They'll eat the residue of what is left, which remains to you from the hail, and they'll eat every tree which grows up for you out of the field. They'll fill your houses and the houses of your servants and the houses of all the Egyptians. Neither your fathers nor your father's fathers have seen anything like this since the day that they were on the earth to this day." And he turned and he went out from Pharaoh. Then Pharaoh's servants said to him, and this was the key verse last week, "How long shall this man be a snare to us? Let the men go that they may serve the eternal their God." And this final plaintive plea on the end of the verse, "Do you not yet know that Egypt is destroyed?" The servants finally tumbled to it before Pharaoh did, that the nation was destroyed. The greatest, most powerful nation on the earth at that time was brought to its knees. That verse has really struck me this spring, and it has stuck with me. Do you not yet know that Egypt is destroyed? I can't recall noticing it so powerfully before this year. And I've been keeping the Days of Unleavened Bread beginning in 1961. That's about 143 of them, I think. Well, actually, it's more than that if you count 7 times, 52 years. But I don't remember seeing it strike me this obviously before. Here's the king, stubborn to the point of destroying his nation. His servants can finally see it, and he's still blind. What was it that destroyed Egypt? It wasn't really God. It was in verse 3, "How long will you refuse to humble yourself before me?" It was Pharaoh's leaven. You've heard of the leaven of the Pharisees. Well, this was the leaven of the Pharisees. That's what destroyed Egypt, his stubborn refusal to humble himself before the power of God. He was arrogant. He was proud. He was egotistical. He was puffed up. Sounds familiar at this time of year, doesn't it? You know, Paul really essentially asked the same question of us in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. We've read that over and over and over again, I'm sure, many times in the spring holy days. If you add just one word, you get the same basic phrase. If you just add the word yet. Because he asked us in 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 6, do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? I was struck by the similarity of the question from the servants of Pharaoh. Just make it, do you not yet know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Mr. Myers talked about only 1/1000th of the mixture would do it. It doesn't take very much. Sin, we know from this week, is what destroys God's people. It destroyed ancient Egypt because Pharaoh would not humble himself before God. And ironically, according to Psalm 95 and Psalm 78, it destroyed the Israelites too, who were the beneficiaries of God's power and mercy toward them in freeing them from slavery in Egypt. And it destroyed them too. Sin destroyed them too. Because those who were over the age of 20 when they left Egypt died in the wilderness and never made it to the promised land. But you know, there's one more lesson, I believe, embedded in these powerful verses. What is Egypt a symbol of during the days of unleavened bread? We saw how Paul made the powerful connection to a Christian's life by comparing the ancient Israelites in 1 Corinthians 10. And he said, here's what happened. Do you not? He said, I want you to understand that they were like us in a way. They were baptized, he said, to Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And they ate of that same spiritual food. They drank of that same spiritual drink. He talked about the rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. He was the one who led them out of Egypt. And so we're connected. He refined and he expanded the analogy in Romans 6. Take a look at Romans chapter 6. Romans 6:16, he says, do you not know? He seems to like that phrase. Do you not know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, you are that one's slaves whom you obey, whether of sin to death or of obedience to righteousness. But God be thanked that though you were slaves of sin, yet you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine to which you were delivered. And having been set free from sin, you became slaves of righteousness. He says, I speak in human terms because of the weakness of your flesh. For just as you presented your members as slaves of uncleanness and of lawlessness leading to more lawlessness, so now present your members as slaves of righteousness for holiness. He follows the analogy. The comparison is direct. He talks about slavery. The Israelites were in slavery. They were set free. He says, you have to make a choice. You're either going to be slaves of sin or you're going to become slaves of righteousness. What was it God wanted ancient Israel to be? Well, they were to be a model nation, weren't they? They were to show the world what it could be like if you would depend on the great God who was the only real God of the universe. All these nations with their multitudes of deities, God humbled the deities of Egypt through the plagues. There was nothing left. Even the magicians finally had to call it quits and say, we can't do this. We can't match this. You can't fight this God. Finally, his servants came to the same conclusion just before the eighth plague, but it took Pharaoh all the way through the tenth one. And even then, he changed his mind and chased after them with his army, didn't he? The analogy is completed in Hebrews 4. Hebrews chapter 4. Therefore, since a promise remains of entering his rest, verse 1, let us fear lest any of you seem to have come short of it. This is after this wrap-up in chapter 3 that I referred to already, citing from the 95th Psalm, reminding us who fell in the wilderness, those who didn't believe. The gospel was preached to us as well as to them, verse 2, but the word which they heard did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in those who heard it. For we who have believed do enter that rest. Israel, the older people, did not. The ones that they said God could not protect, the ones they said would be a prey, their little ones, God said, I'll protect them. They'll come in, and they'll inherit the land that you have despised. So I swore in my wrath, they'll not enter my rest, although the works were finished from the foundation of the world. He goes on, verse 8, if Joshua had given them rest, then he wouldn't have afterward spoken of another day. There therefore remains a rest for the people of God, which refers also to a literal keeping of the Sabbath. For he who has entered his rest has himself ceased from his works, as God did from his. So leaven pictures sin, Egypt pictures sin, and Egypt has a direct tie to slavery. And slavery is what we are in when we're servants of sin, as he said in Romans. Either you're going to be slaves of sin, or you're going to be slaves of righteousness. The analogies are clear. We tie them all together in the analogies and the understanding of this season. We read one connection in Romans 6 already. There's another one we could turn to in Colossians chapter 1. Colossians 1 and verse 9, it says, for this reason we also, since the day we heard it, don't cease to pray for you and to ask that you would be filled with the knowledge of his will in all wisdom and spiritual understanding. God's will is something we understand, the big picture of what he wants for us. That you might have a walk worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing him, being fruitful in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God, strengthened with all might according to his glorious power for all patience and long-suffering with joy, giving thanks to the Father who has qualified us to be partakers of the inheritance of the saints in the light. He has delivered us from the power of darkness. The New International Version gets a little bit alliterative with it and says, delivered us from the dominion of darkness and translated us into the kingdom of the Son of his love, in whom we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of sins. Very much the Spring Festival tie-in, right? And then down to verse 19, for it pleased the Father that in him all the fullness should dwell, and by him to reconcile all things to himself, by him, whether things on earth or things in heaven, having made peace through the blood of his cross. And you, who once were alienated and enemies in your mind by wicked works, yet now he has reconciled in the body of his flesh through death to present you holy and blameless and irreproachable in his sight. But the problem is, verse 23 begins with one of the biggest little words in the English language. If indeed you continue in the faith, grounded and steadfast, and are not moved away from the hope of the gospel, and so on. Where are we going with all this? We still haven't quite gotten to that one more lesson part. But think about all the overlapping analogies we've seen. That Egypt was slavery. Egypt kept God's people away from him, enslaved. We learned that there is a dominion of darkness that God has freed us from now in the New Testament. We've just read it, Colossians 1 and verse 13. And we make sure that we understand the analogy, that we too were enslaved, and God has delivered us. You know, our rejoicing on the night to be much observed harkens back to ancient Israel, but it also reminds us that we've had a much greater deliverance, the deliverance from sin as we enter the days of unleavened bread. Now, keeping all of that in mind and looking to the future, because God's holy days reveal his plan and we've only just started them for this year. We've completed two of the seven festivals at sunset tonight, and also two of the seven holy days, since this festival, the Days of Unleavened Bread, has two holy days in it. So two down, five to go at sunset tonight. And we're just picturing that plan as we step through it every year. Okay, enough hints. Go back to Exodus chapter 10 and read those words again. You may not have to go there. You may have them scorched into your memory already because I keep repeating them. As his servant said to him at the tail end of Exodus 10 and verse 7, "Do you not yet know that Egypt is destroyed?" Again, brethren, I ask, what is Egypt? Egypt is sin. Egypt is the dominion of darkness, by analogy. Egypt is leaven. Egypt is being enslaved to sin. But the message that comes through here, ironically, from Pharaoh's servants, is that Egypt is destroyed. The point I'm making is, whose plan will prevail? Which kingdom wins? And are we where we are supposed to be as we've come through the days of unleavened bread again? Are we finding that we are closer and more harmoniously in tune with the kingdom of the Son of His love, as it was expressed in Colossians 1? Or do we still battle that dead kingdom of Egypt? The destroyed kingdom. The discredited kingdom. Remember what we read in Romans chapter 6, where Paul said in Romans 6, verses 16, 17, and 18, he says, "Do you not yet know?" I'm adding the word "yet" because it just seems to keep cropping up over and over and over again, this phrase. "Do you not yet know that we are either slaves to sin or we are slaves to righteousness?" So we can't go around yelling, "Yay, I'm free, I'm free." Well, yes and no. We're freed from sin. We're freed from the penalty of sin, but we are in harness. We're in God's yoke now. Christ said, "Take my yoke upon you. Take my burden, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." But he didn't say, "You can just go skipping around, you know, doing whatever you want." We are in harness. Whose plow are we pulling? That's the question. Whose servants are we now? What is the future that we can look forward to, which God's plan, beginning once more in these festivals we keep every year, shows us? Turn back to Colossians again, the book of Colossians, chapter 3 this time. It may not yet be evident in the world scene around us. I picked up the Cleveland paper this morning and I almost wished I had. Front page, 3 dead, Brooklyn restaurant, Cracker Barrel restaurant, Tiedemann Road. Been there. Apparently a woman called the police from inside the restaurant and said she felt threatened by her husband. By the time the police arrived, a man was walking out of the restaurant with a gun. The police ordered him to drop the gun. He refused. They shot him dead. When they got inside, they found his wife, one child dead, another one wounded. Wished I hadn't picked it up in some ways. It may not yet be obvious that Egypt is destroyed because we still are here. It's still all around us in some ways. But believe me, it has no more claim to the future. Its credentials are shot, and it can't last. Egypt is destroyed. The question is, do we yet see it? What is it that you and I are looking toward? Colossians chapter 3 and verse 1, it says, "If then you were raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth." Now, of course, we still live here. We still have to pay the bills. We still have to, you know, somehow get along in this world. We understand that. But our hearts are set on the future. Our minds are on the future. Paul told the Philippians that our citizenship is from heaven. Now, I know you probably shouldn't try to pull out a homemade passport if you travel internationally where it's stamped citizen of heaven, because you may spend the time as the guest of one of the governments of this earth. You know, a nice little room with bars in the window, three squares a day, that kind of thing. But we are citizens of the government of God, first and foremost. That's where our first allegiance lies. Christ told Pilate, he said, if my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would fight that I should not be delivered. But now my kingdom's not from here. But that's where our eyes are. That's where our future is. Egypt is destroyed. Can we see that? He says, verse 3, for you died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. That was the analogy of baptism, remember? Romans 6, the first part of the chapter. We didn't read that today. When Christ, who is our life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. You ever think about that? I do sometimes. I wonder, what's that going to feel like? What's that going to be like when he looks around and says, okay, family, everybody ready? It's not a pleasant task ahead of us right now, but is everyone prepared? Put to death your members, which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, covetousness, which is idolatry. Because of these things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience, in which you also once walked when you lived in them. But now you must also put off all these: anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy language out of your mouth. Don't lie to one another, since you have put off the old man with his deeds. The vestiges of Egypt have to be left behind. Brethren, we of all people should know. Do you not yet know, Paul might say to us, that Egypt is destroyed? It's discredited. It can't last. It has no future. Where are we looking? Verse 10 says, and we have put on the new man, who is renewed in knowledge according to the image of him who created him. There's neither Greek nor Jew, circumcised nor uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave or free, but Christ is all and in all. Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humbleness of mind, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with one another and forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, as Christ forgave you, so you must do. But above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. And let the peace of God rule in your hearts, to which also you were called in one body. We're not looking to elements of this world. Egypt is destroyed. And be thankful. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. In fact, it's better for me if I restrict my singing in my heart. And whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. These are the things that have to be put on, the fruits of the Spirit, the attributes of the one who gave himself for us, who set us the example to follow. What does the future hold? We exit the days of unleavened bread, and we remind ourselves that we're to be living a life following the example of the bread of life, Jesus Christ. Which kingdom will rule this earth and the universe? 2 Peter chapter 3. Second Peter 3. Peter says that he writes them just to remind them and stir up their pure minds, he says, of the things that are coming. He talks about in verses 4 and 5 how those in this world are unaware of what's happening, and some of them, if they ever did know it, are willfully forgetting it. And he says, but beloved, verse 8, don't forget this one thing, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. That's hard for us to grasp. Mr. Patchinger talked today about the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic. It's just 100 years ago tomorrow it struck the iceberg, and 100 years ago Sunday it sank. 100 years. Where did the last 100 years go? Not a one of us that I know of here was here at that time. But maybe you've talked to people who were alive back then. Maybe you've talked to people who lived in previous eras and went through things and met others themselves. I still remember one of the most astonishing things of my boyhood as a teenager, talking to a man who was born when Abraham Lincoln was president. It blew my mind. He was 105 when I talked to him, and I was 15. He was born in 1862. Said he remembered the soldiers coming home from the Civil War as a boy of 3. That's living history. But what is that to 1,000 years? I mean, he couldn't tell me about the Crusades. He didn't remember the soldiers coming home from the Crusades. He was, you know, just piddly little stuff, only going back to 1865. We are so limited. And Peter says, just remember, God has a different take on time completely. He is not slack concerning his promise, as some count slackness, but he's long-suffering toward us. He's not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. That's what he wants, but he won't force the issue. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. The earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, the elements will melt with fervent heat? Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, and if I can insert, because we know that Egypt is destroyed, we look for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. Egypt is destroyed. 1 John chapter 2. He reminds us in chapter 2 and verse 15 of the reality of where we live and what we inhabit. Do not love the world or the things in the world, he says. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, is not of the Father, but it's of the world. It is of Egypt, and Egypt is destroyed. And the world is passing away, and the lust of it. But he who does the will of God abides forever. How much does it mean to you to be able to look forward to a future where you don't have aches and pains and limitations, and you don't think too much about the day of your demise, as Mr. Moen was talking about this morning, because there won't be any, because Egypt is destroyed? Which world are we part of? Where is our focus? Is it on the causes of this world? Do we want to latch on to something that's happening in current events and go out and demonstrate and say, you know, do this, do that, make this right, make this right? Is that what we're all about in God's church? Brethren, there are millions of people who have died unjustly and unfairly and in agony. I sometimes wonder if the first sound in the second resurrection will be a collective scream as people wake up. Think back to how they died. Maybe God will grant a kind of collective amnesia. That would be merciful. But you know, in any case, we're going to be there to comfort them and say, you're safe now. It's okay. No one here will hurt you. There's not any of that allowed in this kingdom. Here, let me call my pet lion over and show you what I mean. Here, just pat him on the head. Scratch his belly. He loves to have his belly scratched. Do we know that Egypt is destroyed? This world, you know, there was a movie years and years ago. I never saw it, but I saw the title, and I understood generally what it was about. It was called Dead Man Walking. It was about a condemned prisoner who was going to be put to death, who was going to be executed. And that's the way they apparently described them. Like I said, I never saw the movie, but apparently that's the way they described those on death row. Dead man walking. Well, this world, brethren, is a dead man walking. It's still here, but it has been sentenced to die because it is arranged and arrayed against God. It is arrayed against the King of Kings, and it cannot succeed. And of course, it's spinning down in its death throes in some ways. In fact, we're told in Revelation 20 something pretty astonishing. We quote this verse to refer to the second death, but have you noticed what it says in Revelation 20 and verse 14? It says, "Then death and Hades," that is the grave, "death and the grave were cast into the lake of fire." This is the second death. Anyone not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. Yes, I understand. The incorrigibly wicked, those who refuse to go God's way even when they have a chance. Understand, that's tragic and sad. It's not what God wants. We just read that in 2 Peter 3. But it also tells us here something rather hopeful. Death and the grave are thrown into the lake of fire too. It goes on to say a little bit later in the book that there will be no more death. You've read that too, haven't you? Verse 4 of chapter 21, "God shall wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away." Death is dead as far as God is concerned. Sometimes he speaks of things that will be as if they already are. Do we not yet know, brethren, that Egypt is destroyed? Paul also said in 1 Corinthians 15:26, I won't turn there, he wrote to the Corinthians, "The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death." You know, that sounds awfully good to me. I'm not real keen on the idea of dying. I don't know about you. I admit that I've been blessed in many, many ways in my life, and one of the ways I've been blessed is with reasonably good health. And I understand that can make a big difference. And I know, give it another 20 or 30 years, and there may be things that I begin to say, "Oh, boy, that's just a little stiff this morning. You know, at 90, I might wake up and say, you know, I know I'm not 86 anymore." I understand that time goes by and things could be better. But that's the whole part. Egypt has been destroyed in God's eyes. Sin and death and rebellion and mortality, in God's eyes, are as good as dead in his plan. You and I have just begun one more time, one more year, to reenact that plan. We've only been through the first couple of steps for this year, but believe me, we all know where it leads. And by the time we sing the last hymn and the last amen is ringing out at the last service at the last great day on the 8th of October in 2012, we will have been through the pattern once again, and we'll rejoice again in the knowledge that God's plan is perfect, that no one is left out, that everyone has a chance, and that Egypt is destroyed. Can we learn that from the days of unleavened bread this year? Can we get a head start and see it as we begin the journey? Do we see that the temporary nature of this world and its cares and its leaven and its sin in God's eyes is destroyed? It is discredited. It cannot last. There is only one way to walk in life. God's plan is the only sure future there is for this sin-weary, staggering world. We are to have come out of Egypt in our lives. We are no longer enslaved to sin. Why? because you and I have been blessed to know that Egypt is destroyed.